Welcome to Plural Space, Conversations in Lung Cancer. Our new 12-part limited series is Lung Cancer 201, Expanding Horizons, and features the ways clinicians and advocates across the care continuum are taking lung cancer care and control to new heights.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Plural Space, Conversations in Lung Cancer. My name is Hannah Burson, a program manager with the American Cancer Society National Lung Cancer Roundtable. Today's episode of our Expanding Horizons series discusses the first step of getting lung cancer screening, working with referring providers. Mike, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I'm Michael Gieske, MD. I'm a family physician. I've been in practice for 36 years. And I saw my last patient in the office December 27th, but I'm still doing lots of work with our lung cancer screening program. I'm the director of our lung cancer screening program, and I've been doing that officially for about 3.5 years now. And just briefly, in the way of background, I was asked to join the thoracic oncology disease management team as the primary care representative back in 2016. And at the time, I didn't even know what a low-dose CT lung cancer screen was. The American Academy of Family Practice actually did not officially endorse lung cancer screening until April of 2021. And we were taught as a provider group why not to do lung cancer screening. So that's been a barrier in itself. And at the time when I walked into this meeting, I found out that, my gosh, we got something that can make such a tremendous difference. We can catch this deadly disease earlier and really change people's lives and catch it early. And even if we catch it late, we can make a difference as well. And we really started promoting it to our primary care providers, and our program has really taken off exponentially. And it's been a very rewarding experience. We got a great team, and it's been just fascinating to see the progress we've made and the difference we've made in people's lives and their families' lives.
Teresa.
I am a nurse practitioner with Maine Health, Maine Medical Center. I started with Maine Health in the thoracic oncology outpatient clinic, and I was assigned or tasked to build the lung screening program for Maine Medical Center. So that was where I started as an NP, and I since then have moved on to study long COVID with the Recover NIH grant, seeing patients in the long COVID clinic until its closure late in December.
And Denise.
My name is Denise Lee, and I'm a lung cancer survivor. Early detection lung cancer screening actually saved my life. I became aware of it, not in my doctor's office, but when I was stuck in traffic on the side of the road. And I looked up at a billboard, and it said, if you smoke or smoked in the past 15 years, this test could change your life or could save your life. And I looked at it, and I said, huh, that's interesting, because I'd never heard anything about it. And I went to my primary care physician, and she ordered it for me, and it saved my life. So I'm very happy to be here.
And so, Denise, I think your story and your approach to lung screening is fairly unique. You came at it from a personal advocation sort of side. You talked to your doctor about getting screened. Can you talk to us a little bit more about how you did that and how they responded?
Sure. When I went to my primary care physician, I said, oh yeah, and by the way, I saw this billboard and it said something about low-dose CT scan and I've never heard of it. Can you order it? And she, consulted the guidelines and she said, well, I don't think you qualify for this. I can't order it. You don't qualify. Like, well, okay, whatever. And then I went up on the American Lung Association had campaign safebythescan.org. And I gave myself a little quiz. And sure enough, I qualified. And a couple, 2 or 3 months later, I went back for a totally unrelated situation. And I said, oh, yeah, by the way, I did this lung cancer screening test. And the American Lung Association says that I qualified. And so I want you to order it. And she looked at me and she looked at the guidelines again. And she says, okay, yeah, you do seem to qualify, so I'll order it. And next thing, she ordered it and I had the scan. And so that's what it is. But I definitely had to advocate on behalf of myself. So that was important for me.
What year was that? I'm just curious.
January of 2018. About a month after I retired.
Oh, wow. 5 years out.
Yes.
We seem to be coming further and further along each passing year, but it also speaks to the importance of advertising and marketing. We need to create an awareness. And I think that that's a big piece of what's been missing within lung screening. But I think we've come a long way.
And like I said, I didn't even know anything about it. She basically got on me every year, every time I went to see her about quitting smoking. And so here I quit smoking and I asked her, I want this test. And she says, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. And I'm like, wait, what? You know, I'm just glad that I ultimately got it and it helped save my life.
Yeah, that's music to my ears. I bet you that probably 90 to 95% of the lung cancer screens that we order are through health maintenance prompts or best practice alerts that come up to the providers or their provider or medical assistant generated. But you know, one of our earliest success stories was similar to your story, Denise. We had a patient came in, she saw a flyer on the bulletin board. She told her provider, you know, I think I meet those criteria. And she had a low-dose CT lung cancer screen, and it turned out to be a 1A2 or 1A3 adenocarcinoma, and she had it surgically removed, and she's probably 5 or 6, 7 years out now. She was one of our earliest patients and one of our greatest success stories, and she's one of our greatest advocates too. Just like you, Denise, if you can find those patients that are willing to tell their story, and it's not for everybody, but that is very powerful and very moving and some of the best marketing that we can have for lung cancer screening.
So opposed from a patient asking specifically, like you were saying, Mike, it's normally prompted by alerts in the system. Can you talk about what it looks like from the referring provider side?
Oh, sure. So one of the most important things, we've kind of alluded to this already, is education and communication. And the education is not just for providers, but it's for the medical assistants, it's for the managers, for the executives, it's for everybody that's involved in healthcare, the nurses in the hospital. And then just equally as important, the community. And we can target different communities. We can get education through churches, through community outreaches, through senior fairs, through events like Juneteenth, Esperanza, trying to target the minority underserved populations. Any way we can get that word out there can help tremendously and try to get everybody to converge, knowing that lung cancer screening is available. It does make a difference. And it's one of the simplest screening tests you can have. Now, if somebody comes into our office and they meet the criteria, and again, we're using USPSTF 2021 criteria, which means that you have to have smoked within the last 15 years. You have to have 20 pack years, which means you smoked a pack a day for 20 years or half a pack a day for 40 years. And you have to be between the ages of 50 and 80. If you meet those criteria, our health maintenance will alert the provider and the medical assistant that this patient qualifies. They haven't had a low-dose CT ever or within the last year. And they also get what's called a BPA, best practice alert, which also alerts the provider that this patient meets criteria. And then once the patient meets criteria, then you have the conversation with them. We have this test that's available. It can make a big difference. And the problem with lung cancer, it's very aggressive. It moves quickly through the stages. And unfortunately, lung cancer historically has been caught in the late stages. We now have this amazing test that can make a tremendous difference. It literally takes 3 minutes. You know, you can leave the clothes on that you came into the apartment with. I tell my patients, there's nothing in you, up you, down you, through you, nothing gets squeezed. You walk in and you're out of the apartment, back in your car within 15 minutes. There's lots of great research and lots of great results to support this test. So hopefully by the time you do that sales pitch, if the patient comes in already knowing about the test or wanting the test, that's easy. But sometimes it's a little bit harder to sell the patient the test.
I'm sitting here laughing while you're describing that because I remember I went in, it was about 2.5 minutes and I'm like, wait a minute, is that it? You know? Yeah.
Yeah, and that is what patients would often ask. They want to know how long it is. And when they found out it's so short, it's so simple. And one of the biggest fears that people had is it's like that MRI, and they talk about being enclosed. I'm like, no, you can actually see the wall on the other side. It's very open. There's a fan going. It's aerated. It's so fast, and you have to do nothing to prepare. I mean, it's the simplest screening, I think, out there. And we think about screenings in general, and you know, what could be more challenging than a colonoscopy? So, you know, I think this is important that people know it's very fast, very easy, and we can have good results from it.
So, Teresa, why don't you share a little bit about your role in lung cancer screening from a tobacco cessation perspective?
Yeah, I did a lot of smoking cessation shared decision-making consults over the years when I was within the context of the program at Maine Med. And so I had a little bit of the luxury of time with patients, which was nice. And so I was able to really have really meaningful conversations with people about this. And I got to really get a sense of who they were and got that trust, you know, that's so important from the moment you walk in the room with the patient. You know, it starts immediately, you know, where you're sort of trying to understand the patient's trying to understand you. And then those first words, those sentences really matter. And then where the conversation can go is amazing. And what I found out is that people really have a story to tell, and they want to tell their story of smoking, when they started, how they quit, what they tried, who in their family smoked, maybe history of lung cancer within their family. I had one patient at one point, you know, share kind of proudly, I started smoking at 9 months old. And I thought to myself, how is that possible? And I said, explain. And she said, I used to sit on my grandfather's lap and he'd smoke a cigarette and blow the smoke in my face. And I started officially smoking, she said, like around 7 years old. So it is fascinating, the stories that people share. It's pretty powerful. And I think you can leverage those stories to really develop that trust and then to really help people to sort of own the idea of quitting and thinking about being good stewards of their lung health. And I was able to do that with a lot of patients. And I can tell you that I often gauged it by when I call patients to share results, they would thank me. And they would also say, I thought long and hard about what you said to me yesterday. I left, I got out to the car, I was going to have a cigarette and I didn't. And I thought about it all night. Those are conversations that take a bit of time, but they're well worth the time.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Teresa. It's so critically important that patients quit smoking, no matter what their situation is. You know, if you quit smoking, you're of course going to be less likely to develop emphysema, chronic lung disease of any kind, coronary artery disease, cerebrovascular disease. And you know, the list goes on and on. There's lots of other cancers that are caused by smoking. But if you are unfortunate enough to have a lung cancer and you have surgery, you heal up so much better if you have quit smoking. And the thing that's been surprising to me over the years is how many times I see patients that go to have surgery and they not only have one cancer, but they have two or three cancers in the biopsy specimen, or there are two nodules and you take out both and they're two different types of cancers, or they come up with another lung cancer 2, 3, 4, 5 years later in a different lobe or a different part of the chest that is a totally different cancer, not related to the original cancer. And unfortunately, people that get lung cancer have a certain genetic predisposition to getting cancer. And so we have to follow these patients very closely, really forever, once they're diagnosed with lung cancer. And quitting smoking is so imperative to reduce that risk.
I agree. And I think that the conversations for people who are smoking, you know, quitting smoking is such a delicate conversation. You have to really handle it with respect and grace. And again, knowing the patient's history really does help position you to have a meaningful conversation with patients. But it is, you know, just understanding how difficult it is and then trying to, with so many patients, help them quit over time. And never giving up, losing hope, you know, and just knowing that if you stop and then you restart, it's okay. It's a new day. We start again. That support is absolutely critical to helping people quit smoking.
Oh, I totally agree. As a former smoker, I found that to be my experience as well. I felt judged when I smoked. I felt judged when I couldn't quit. I felt judged when I went back to smoking. I felt judged every time I talked to my doctors about smoking, and I just felt alone. I felt as if I was out here by myself. And I remember I smoked for 20 years and then I quit. I quit for a couple of years and I started out smoking menthol cigarettes. And then when I relapsed, I went to non-menthol. It was the hardest thing that I have ever done. It took me 40 years to quit smoking. But I can only imagine how I would have felt had I still been smoking and diagnosed with cancer. You know, I just feel for those people, knowing how hard it is to quit smoking and getting a lung cancer diagnosis. And, you know, I do mentoring where I talk to people who are diagnosed and some of them are still smokers. And everything that, you know, Mike said was true, quitting smoking, it allows you to heal quicker. You know, you don't have some of the complications. But it is just incredibly hard. So I think kindness, compassion, understanding are so critical, particularly at that time.
I think another important component of this is that we have to tell our patients that qualify for lung cancer screening that, you know, lung cancer can happen to anyone. Anyone with lungs can get lung cancer. And 15 to 20% of the lung cancers that we see are not related to smoking. And eventually, hopefully, the guidelines will change and we'll find ways of capturing that other 15 to 20% of people that develop lung cancer that never smoked. But even in patients that have a history of smoking, the message should be that, look, this isn't something that you had complete control over, that you did to yourself. I mean, tobacco is a terribly addictive chemical. And for many years, tobacco smoking was glamorized and it was the popular thing to do. And as kids, we've all been there. You like to do things that aren't good for your body sometimes, and you can get addicted and hooked at a very early age.
Compassion and empathy is so important because people struggle. And when they tell you every day, I want to quit, and I think of quitting all day long, and here I am another day and I haven't quit. So you can imagine how difficult that would be. And so I think that it's just, again, trying to kind of respect where they're at and then trying to kind of guide them along or, you know, take their hand and just walk with them on their journey, because it's so, so important knowing how difficult it is to quit. And there's a lot of things that are involved in smoking and quitting. And that's the piece we have to remember as well, just that social aspect, the habit. It's kind of worked into the fabric of your day, you know, within increments of 15 minutes, half hour, hour, depending upon how much you smoke. That's profound. There's no other addiction that is like that. And so really thinking about that piece, I remember we were staying at a hotel and there were some housekeepers and they were lovely and going through and cleaning the rooms, and we were going out around noontime and they went for a cigarette break in their car, and we went out to our car and I saw them smoking and they were laughing and having fun. And I thought, see, this is that piece that we have to respect. It's this social connectivity that was happening over a cigarette. So again, there's a lot to it if you think about it.
I remember when I first quit, my big issue was, how was I going to drink coffee without a cigarette? And so the first month that I quit smoking, I switched to Pepsi. And that helped me break the habit of the coffee and the cigarette. That's how bad it was for me. It's like, how am I going to do this? I need my caffeine, but if I drink coffee and I'm not smoking, it's going to be a trigger. So how do I get around this?
Yeah. And the idea of recognizing triggers is really important. And people are really good about it once you kind of introduce that idea, and they start to really be aware of it. And so they kind of think, if I do this, it's going to result in that, so I won't do that. You know, quitting smoking is something that has to be almost dynamic, and you have to be so flexible, because what works one day may not work the next. And so you have to constantly kind of adjust the way you go through the day in order to support the quitting, I think.
So once you advocate for yourself, or your referring provider, your primary care physician talks to you about screening, you have a shared decision-making visit, how do you make screening a habit? What suggestions do you have for people? And how do they combat fear of follow-up screening?
Yeah, I think it continues to be a bit of a source of anxiety for patients to have that scan every year. But, you know, once you have that initial screen and it's clear, I mean, you get a certain tremendous sense of relief. And the risk is that you're going to get this one and done kind of approach that, whew, I don't have cancer, I can go back to smoking, or thank God I quit smoking, or whatever the case is, and maybe not be so inclined to get that annual screen. But part of the shared decision making that we're required to do on the initial baseline screen is you have to talk to your patients about smoking cessation or continued abstinence. And you have to emphasize that this has to be done every year, and you have to agree to this until either you're 80 years of age, if you're using USPSTF 2021 criteria, or it's been 15 years since you quit. And the saddest thing you ever see is that somebody's had a baseline screen, and 2-3 years later, they haven't followed up, and then daggone it, they show up with stage 3 or stage 4 lung cancer. It can happen that fast. And so the studies were specifically targeted for patients that were high risk. They had a very dense smoking history. They were at an age where you're, of course, most likely to get lung cancer. And it's so important that these individuals that are high risk for getting lung cancer continue to get screened every year, at least until they're 80, or it's been 15 years since you quit. That's a hard sell sometimes, but you have to really emphasize that we've seen patients that have missed a year and they came up with cancer. And usually if you go a couple years and you catch it, it's probably going to be stage 1 or stage 2. But if you go 3 or 4 years and it shows up, bad things can happen.
Yeah, I think that the annual screening, I mean, it does require a commitment, but many screenings do, you know, on the part of the patient. But I also think that even having a frank conversation with patients, the onus for the most part is on them. And I have this conversation all the time with patients. And so, you know, what I say to them is, you walk out of here, I have no control over anything you do, you know, and you've lived 50 years without me even knowing you, if I'm meeting them for the first time. That's pretty profound. And so I think it's just really kind of having an impact, that first visit that matters so much, because what you want them to do is walk away and really think about their lung health, potentially in a way that they hadn't thought of before. So rather than worrying about their lung health, maybe thinking about becoming an advocate of your lung health, and not just for given the risk of lung cancer, but also any other type of disease that could happen within the body, and especially within the lungs, emphysema, you know, things like that. Those are conversations that are important to have with patients as well about other types of disorders that they could have, even if they don't have lung cancer.
It's incumbent upon us as well to really impress it upon providers, because providers have some of that same approach sometimes, the one and done. My patient was at risk for lung cancer, I got a clean screen. They have a lowered threshold for ordering that repeat annual screen. And it's so important. With lung cancer, almost more than any of the other cancers we screen for, it moves so aggressively and so quickly through the stages that it's imperative that you catch it in an early stage. But at the same time, even if we catch it in stage three or stage four, the later stages, we can make a tremendous difference with those patients. And that's a big part of how we need to sell lung cancer screening too, because a lot of people are so afraid that even if you find lung cancer, there's nothing you can do about it anyway. We've been so used to seeing lung cancer equals death. And that is definitely not the case now. We catch it early, sure, you can cut it out or get SBRT or radiation treatment and cure it very easily in the early stages. But even in stage three and stage four now, we can make a tremendous difference with lung cancer. We got patients now that are 5, 10, 15, 20 years out from stage three and stage four lung cancer that have no evidence of disease. Are they cured? Probably some of them. It's a little bit early to say. The technology and the science is moving quickly, and we probably have cured some of these people now with the new technologies that are available. Denise, do you want to maybe speak to your experience? I mean, you are 5 years out now from your cancer diagnosis.
I had a friend of mine just recently who called me to tell me that her husband was just diagnosed with lung cancer. She is very upset. And I told her, I said, you know, if you're going to have lung cancer, now's the best time to have it, because there's so much going on, so much research, so many new treatments. Lung cancer is no longer, I have it and I'm going to die in 6 months. And I say, even for myself, that it's a really, really hopeful time in lung cancer treatment, provided they can find it early enough. You know, and as Mike said, sometimes not early enough, but there's just so much. There's so much new. There's so much different. That was one of the things that really made the difference for me in my early treatment, was the knowledge that there's so many different treatment options that are available. And even if I were to have a recurrence, at least there are different options, more options. It's just a wonderful time.
Yeah.
It's hopeful. As a lung cancer patient, I needed hope. You know, treatment is hope.
Absolutely. Knowledge is hope. So you start with the education piece, and then you talk about the potential, what are the options and which ones are right for you. That immediately gives people hope.
One of the things that I also did was, in order for me to get information, I had to look. My sister, fortunately, gave me reputable sources. When I say reputable, I mean sources that had good information, that had accurate information. And so I would look at those. And when I started to see, based on my own quote unquote research, all of the developments in the treatment of lung cancer. And this was when I was going through treatment. I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Look at all this stuff, you know, and that really helped me.
You mentioned, you know, having the reputable sources is really important, because, you know, we all know a lot of people will go Google the heck out of it, and then they'll just focus on the cancer, the worst scenario, and it's hard. And so then, you know, you see them and they're in a really rough position emotionally, and it's kind of trying to reel that in and sort of get them back to sort of ground floor and then give them the education they need. You know, that brings me to what was referred to as scanxiety, and the idea of, you know, having the anxiety around scanning and repeated imaging on follow-up and so on. Denise, you had said that you had that experience in the past.
I didn't really have a lot of anxiety when I went in for the actual scan, but I had a lot of anxiety when I went for follow-up. And then I just finally, for me, just realized, you know, I don't have any control over any of this stuff. You know, I just have no control. So I can either worry about it at the time if something happens, or I can worry about it now and waste all this time worrying about it. You know, the first time I had a follow-up scan after I was diagnosed and had my scan, and 10 minutes later, my results were not up, you know, and I called my oncologist. It's been 10 minutes, you know, and you really, that's true. It was about 10 minutes.
Result yesterday.
10 minutes and it's not up, something's wrong. And he's like, okay, it's been 10 minutes. I know, but I need to have the answer. Now, the last one I had, I didn't call him. I've gotten to the point where I can look at it and realize, just read the last line of the results and that will tell you the answer. You know, it's kind of funny when I look back on some of the stuff that I did. But it's real.
Yeah.
But I've evolved. Now I wait, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes before it's been 45 minutes, you know?
Yeah, and you have to really, you know, pause and realize that when it gets released to the patient portal, and some people, I mean, it's on their phone, on their watch.
And it's before the doctor's seen it.
Yeah, that's happened to me.
I don't understand that, but yeah.
Yeah, and that's hard from the perspective of a provider, because you know, you're trying to beat the patient to it, especially if there's a finding. And then patients will sometimes then start to go into a tough time, you know, emotionally, because you have to respect the idea that they're not clinically trained. If they're not clinicians, they don't have the knowledge and the experience. And so the challenge is that they go to all these dark places and they don't understand the language that's being used often. That's really tricky. I'm sure that, Michael, you've had challenges like that.
Oh, absolutely. Modern medicine. Welcome to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
To kind of close out this conversation, if you had one piece of advice for patients who want to talk to their primary care physicians about screening or about the whole screening process in general, what would you tell them?
You know, my advice is certainly don't hesitate to ask about it, you know, talk to your physician about it. And without a doubt, there's an incredible amount of hope now for patients at risk for lung cancer and with lung cancer. And any way we can get that message out there is going to go a long way to improving the health of our patients and reducing the lung cancer burden and tobacco-related disease burden in our state, in our country, and it's going to make a tremendous difference.
Yeah, I agree. Just, you know, being an advocate of your health and taking ownership. And I would also add, you know, just sort of thinking about all the things that people can do therapeutically that are free, you know, and benign. So, you know, exercise, getting outside every day, healthy diet, and all of those other things that are so vital to help, really good quality sleep. And how do you get that? Well, if you can reduce the stress, which isn't always easy, but that's something that keeps people up at night, is really important, how they are day to day and really being aware of their emotions. And I think that's vital to health.
I would say don't be afraid. Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine who's afraid to get her scan. And I get that. You know, nobody wants a lung cancer diagnosis. I certainly didn't. But I was glad that I had the scan and it was caught.
I think you make a good point, Denise. I think it's that fear can prevent us from doing a lot of things. But I think that it's, you know, important to recognize, yeah, I understand why you're afraid. I mean, we're all afraid of various things. But I guess I would also sort of nudge them 2 or 3 years from now, if you go and have the imaging and you find out that you've got advanced lung cancer, think about what you would probably be telling yourself. If I had done the screening 3 years ago, this wouldn't have happened. Look what I did to myself. It's just they'd put more blame on themselves. So I think those can be helpful conversations to send people home with, honestly.
Plural Space is a joint production by the American Cancer Society National Lung Cancer Roundtable in the American College of Radiology. Episodes are executive produced by Hannah Burson and Beverly Carlisle, with series production assistance by Tiffany Gowan, Lauren Rosenthal, and Kenley Byrne. Editing of this series is by Port City Films. Find more information on this series at the link in the episode description.